Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour in the afternoon each weekday taking your calls. Mostly if you have questions about the Christian faith or about the Bible or about theology or ethics or your own spiritual quest, these are the things we talk about here. And we allow, you know, the conversation to go pretty far and wide if within those boundaries. And if you have questions on anything roughly religious or spiritual, we'd be glad to talk to you about them. And the number to call, since our lines are open now, if you'd like to get on, the number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. I want to make an announcement, maybe a couple announcements, and that is that tomorrow night from 7:30 to 9, I will be debating an atheist on a, what do you call it, a webcast out of Oregon. I'll be doing it over the phone from my home. But it's about an hour and a half broadcast or webcast that you may be interested in tuning into. Now, the way you get to it, to tune into it, is you have to enter a really long email or IP address. And I can't really get that out over the air effectively. There's too many letters and numbers in it. But you can go to my Facebook page if you've never been there, or if you have, just go to the Facebook page under my name, Steve Gregg, and you'll find an announcement there with a link to it. And so you can link to the show tomorrow night. It'll be playing from 7:30 to 9 tomorrow night. And an atheist who has challenged me to debate him and I will be facing off, but not face-to-face, but over the phone. All right, just thought I'd make that announcement since it's coming up and it's impending. Let's talk to Art from Salinas, California, first of all today. Art, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. Hi. I'm just calling in today with like a social commentary. You know, I've been following social trends in our country. And seeing how they affect Christianity, you know, in our country, how they influence Christianity and how they change the landscape of our families. And in my research that I've done and my reading, I've come across like a movement, a social movement, a cultural movement in our country called polyamoral, which means many loves. A person that has many loves, many relationships at the same time. It's a polyamoral, and it's, as I was, you know, researching this, because I'm a member of a meetup group that goes hiking every now and then, but amongst meetup groups, there's also meetup groups for polyamoral people, you know, that meet up and they do social events or whatever they do. And then I found that that's like a bigger movement countrywide. So I remember a while back when same-gender marriage was the big topic, it still is, and there was change amidst, the proponents would say it'll never come to multiple partners, marriages with multiple partners.
Right.
But based on what I see, you know, and then again, you know, once the popular culture gets behind something and gives it empathy, you know, it propels it forward, you know, and it's hard to stop once the popular culture gets behind something.
Oh, yeah. Well, with the legalization of same-sex marriage, it really has removed every philosophical objection to any kind of marriage, including polygamy, you know, bestiality, you name it. Virtually every kind of marriage that people might crave, or I should say every kind of sexual encounter that people might crave, these people will have as much right to claim the right to marry the one that they're interested in or the ones they're interested in as anybody else has, because there's now no longer any standard definition of marriage. The definition of marriage for 6,000 years was one way, and that was recently changed in this country to favor the interests of you know, maybe 3% or less of the population because of their unusual sexual orientation. And, of course, there's a smaller percentage who really like to who'd like to do a lot of other strange things sexually, and I won't go into them because, well, they're very perverse. But frankly, if they claim that they love this other party, and that they should not be deprived of the right to marry them, then what philosophical argument can be given against it, since we now have dislodged the definition of marriage from anything historical or cultural or biblical? So you're right. I'm certainly we're going to have a polygamous marriage before long, and incestuous marriage, and bestiality marriage too. I mean, people might think I'm extreme here, but let's face it, there are people who are interested in that kind of union. They are a very small minority, but so are the homosexuals. Homosexuals are a very small minority, but they stood up and people said, well, hey, why should they be left out of this? Why can't marriage be a big umbrella that just means anyone who has any sexual tastes at all can just kind of call their relationship a marriage? Well, I guess they can now. And all that means is marriage doesn't mean anything. The word marriage is a word that doesn't contain any distinctive meaning anymore.
Yeah. And what I see is that the popular culture, or what I call the hipster culture, is what gives it empathy or sympathy. And then once that gets going, it's difficult to stop. It just goes forward, you know?
Well, I think you're right. It's, as they say, a snowballing thing. It's a slippery slope. It's something that the brakes are off now, or at least they've been loosed.
Yeah.
And we, you know, unless there's a return to some objective moral basis for marriage being what it used to be, there really can't be any philosophical argument or legal argument, ultimately,
yeah,
to define marriage more narrowly than anyone wants to define it.
Yeah. And the whole polyamoral thing is, it ultimately does lead to polygamy. They go hand in hand.
Oh, I'm sure it would. Yeah. I mean, if you're having multiple meaningful relationships, then of course you're going to want to, eventually people who are agreeable to that are going to want to marry. They're going to want those things, in other words, formalized so that they'll be considered respectable.
Right. Okay. And typically what I found is that you find this in the big urban cities, but then again, you find polygamy in rural areas of Utah and northern Arizona.
Well, right, and that's largely because of the Mormon tolerance of polygamy until the last century. and there's a lot of Mormons who still believe that true Mormonism allows and encourages polygamy. So they're break-off groups from the main church, but wherever there's a lot of those types, there's going to be polygamy practiced, whether it's legal or not. Art, I'm going to have to take another call, but I appreciate your commentary.
Thank you.
All right, God bless you. Bye now. All right, our next caller is Rich, also calling from Salinas. Two calls in a row from Salinas. And our phone number is 1-800-438-5090, if you'd like to be on the program. 1-800-438-5090. Rich, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. I'm hitting Rich's button on my computer, and it's not activating the call. So could somebody in the studio do that? I don't know what's the hang-up here. Okay, for some reason, Rich's call is not activating. The button is doing nothing. Studio, can you do anything for me on that? Okay, I'm hearing nothing there. Well, where do we go from here? All right, I'll tell you what. I'm going to have to... Now we've got... I think we may have him activated. Let me see here. Okay, Rich, okay, we got you going now. I don't know what was wrong before. Welcome.
I don't know. I was just talking to Dave at the station there. And
okay.
But I'm next. Okay, goodbye, Dave. In any event, I just pulled in and turned the radio on, and I heard the end of the conversation previously. I'm just curious on this new law for the kids going into either bathroom. Is that only for the schools, or are they going to come out in society and public, and we're going to have that out there too, and all of a sudden we're going to have people getting arrested?
I don't know what's going to happen legally in that respect. I mean, as far as I know, it only affects the schools at this time, but I don't really know how far that's going to be. If it's going on in the schools, of course, they can't very well keep it out of society at large. So I don't know.
That's what I'm thinking, because the kids have more rights than us if we want to do that, huh? Not that we want to, but all of a sudden now these kids, you know what they're going to do. They're going to take this out into the public.
I'm sure they will.
I mean, there's a law that was passed, you know. They're going to stand up for their rights.
Yep, it's a different world than we grew up in.
Oh, boy, is it?
Yeah.
I guess, you know, it's part of the Communist Manifesto anyway, is to dumb down the family, break it up any way they can, and if they can do it through the kids, well, the next generation's broken down, and they're not following what their parents hopefully have good values.
Well, the marriage in this country was destroyed not from the bottom down or bottom up from the children. It was done by divorce, by easy divorce. This is back in the 1960s.
No-fault divorce.
Yeah, no-fault divorce is what destroyed the family.
Well, you know, it's an incremental thing on everything they're doing, whether it's the education system or health care or anything else they try to do with global warming. It's all a big farce, and it's all designed to break down society. This is just another step in the matter. And if
all
they
right.
slowly do it and they attack us from everywhere, we don't know where to turn, where do we fight the battle, you know?
Well, we may decide to become the church for a change. You know, it may be that someday we will be so discouraged about changing society through politics or whatever that we'll just decide that we have to do what the church has always done in the best times in the past, and that is be the church, just be an alternative society, be a countercultural movement.
That's also part of their corruption. They've been getting into the churches and corrupting the churches, too.
Yeah, I know, but I'm not talking about the institutional church. I'm talking about the Christian community actually living as a society separate, that is, by separate standards, a countercultural movement within the country. We're already countercultural because the dominant culture has long since given up on Christianity or given up on the claims of Christ.
Well, yeah. Even Rick Warren, he was part of either the Trilateral Commission or the Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, those rumors. I don't really, I don't know much about that. But I, as far as I know, Rick Warren is a brother. I don't know very much about him personally because I haven't looked into it. But I, you know, people, rumors float around about anyone who's making an impact. And I'm not saying that everything that Rick Warren's doing is that all the impact he's making is of a positive sort. But I think he's a brother who's trying to serve God, and I'd rather not circulate rumors that I can't substantiate about another brother.
Well, I mean, I heard that a number of times. So,
yeah, hearing something a number of times doesn't mean it's true. Yeah.
Yes.
I've heard some things about me a number of times that weren't true. Also, so
anyway, I work with homeless people, drug addicts, and alcoholics, and I get all kinds of things talked about me.
I'll bet you do. All right, Rich.
Yes. All right, thanks.
Hey, God bless you for your call. Bye now. Okay, Dean from Carmel, California is next. Dean, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good.
Hey, a quick question, kind of a situation I'm in. I have a client of mine who, they're both friends of mine as well, and they're both women, and they got married years ago, and are renewing their vows now that the state of California has accepted it as a marriage. And they've asked me to attend, my wife and I to attend. So they know my belief, they know my faith, and I would make it very clear to them that I don't agree with it. I don't agree. God doesn't agree with it, and I don't. But they've been my friends for years, and I've shared with them and so on and so forth. So I'm not too sure where our position should be in regards to partaking in such event. I mean, I would find out ahead of time if it was actually a quote-unquote Christian pastor doing the service, and then I definitely wouldn't go.
Right.
But if I was to be there and allow, you know, just to let them know where I am on it, and if they still are okay with me coming under those, you know, conditions, would that be okay biblically?
Well, this comes up now from time to time because Christians are more and more in your position. I would say a person has to make their own decision about what it means to them to attend a wedding.
Right.
See, if attending a wedding just means you're witnessing, you know, a passage in the lives of some of your friends,
mm-hmm.
that's one thing. If it means that you are giving some kind of, you're bearing witness to a sacred ceremony,
right,
which you intend to hold them accountable to maintain their vows in, that's what a marriage should be. That's what attending a marriage should mean, a
right.
wedding. And, you know, but I, because I take the latter view of going to a wedding, I don't believe I could go to a same-sex wedding. I couldn't go to a wedding of two parties that were friends of mine if I believed their marriage was adulterous either.
Right.
That is, you know, in other words, if a woman had left her husband for no good reason and then married someone else and was committing adultery, I wouldn't go to that wedding either. And it's not, you know, it has nothing to do with homophobia, because in that case it wouldn't be homosexuals, it would be heterosexuals. It's just that I have a distinctively Christian view of marriage, and that includes a sense of marriage being a very sacred thing. Now, if they didn't want to call this marriage, if they were just having a civil ceremony, that'd be different. But now they've insisted on calling it marriage, and it's kind of drawing the line in the sand for us to say, okay, are we going to give in and say, yeah, what you're doing is marriage. We're going to go ahead and grant you that this is marriage, and we're just going to say that marriage has now been redefined, and we're accepting that. I'm not willing to go there. Like I said, if it was two friends having a civil ceremony that had nothing to do, they didn't call it marriage. They just wanted to people to witness that they were going to be hanging out together and living together, and maybe even have some kind of commitment together. I still would not enjoy going, because there's certain things about it I think would find, I'm sorry to say, nauseating. I'm not trying to be offensive to homosexuals who are listening, but frankly, there are things that would happen there that I would find difficult
would
to stomach.
Would you take the same stance in regards to, say, your daughter or son that, you know, were in the same situation as far as...
Absolutely. Yeah, if my daughter or my son were... Fortunately, none of my children are homosexual, but if they were, and if they're getting married, I would not approve, and I wouldn't attend. I certainly wouldn't give away my daughter to another woman.
Right.
You know, I mean, how could you do this? You see,
no, I understand.
I believe that this redefinition of marriage to include same-sex marriage has simply put the homosexual community in a position they were not actually in before, vis-a-vis Christians, and that is. You know, Christians may have objected before to homosexual behavior, just like we object to adultery or other things.
Mm-hmm.
But if a person was not professing to be a Christian and not co-opting Christian institutions for themselves, I would, for one, would have always been willing to, you know, maintain a very good friendship with people who are homosexuals or adulterers, as long as they're not claiming to be Christian. But when people are claiming to be Christian, or when they're asking you to acknowledge what they're doing,
right,
to be some sacred thing, and that's what marriage is, as far as I'm concerned as a Christian,
yeah.
I'm afraid they've drawn a line in the sand. They say you have to come over to my way, or separate yourself. And I guess when it comes to that, I have to separate myself.
Okay.
I'm sorry to say. I know that it's probably going to offend your friends, and you may make a different decision. I won't condemn
yeah.
you. But
no,
I think
I've talked to my pastor in depth on it as well, and also guys I meet with on Tuesday group, and I'm getting mixed, you know, and I definitely want to do the right thing, and if I have any question, I definitely lean on the safe side, if you will.
Yeah, I think you should say, if you decide not to go, I think you should say very clearly, you know, I don't have anything against you two people, you know, I mean, we all have our own, you know, imperfections, and I consider that I don't have any place to judge you for where you have your struggles. But I can't endorse marriage that isn't what I understand to be marriage, because I'm informed from God, from His Word, you know, about what marriage is, and I'm not able to really cancel out what He has to say about that or pretend like He didn't say anything about it.
Right. Yeah, they're friends of mine, they're clients of mine, and we've been very close. So, I mean, like you said, as far as drawing the line in the sand, there is, you know, one, I guess, what you're saying, there's one point you got to draw it and go.
Well, they know that you've been nice to them in the
yeah.
past. They know that if you don't go to the wedding, that it's not because you're homophobic. It has to do with your convictions about marriage.
Right. Okay, perfect.
All right, Dean.
And thanks for your help. I totally appreciate it.
All right. God bless you.
Bless you as well.
Bye now. All right, our next caller is Daniel from Sparks, Nevada. Daniel, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi, Steve. New listener, longtime Christian.
Uh-huh.
Listening to your last conversation with Guy, and sometimes I think you have to forsake others, you know? Like, we're not going to answer. He's not going to answer to his those two lady friends on Judgment Day, you know?
Yeah, I think he knows
that. You're true to God, you know?
Yeah, I think the dilemma that persons like him have is that they... You know, they do associate with these people, and rightly so. If,
sure.
If these people are not Christians, then there's no obligation to cut them off from your social group or whatever. But what does it mean to attend a wedding? See, to them, it might just mean that they've invited their friends to come and be happy with them. You know, I'm sure that's what they're thinking. To a Christian, I think a wedding
means
that you're watching something that God has ordained take place, and you're hearing vows being made in the most sacred of all situations, and you are there as a witness to help keep the couple accountable to keep their vows. Yeah, and so you can't do that.
Let you go, you know? I think it is.
Yeah.
Kind of an endorsement. Anyway, it's not really the reason I called. I was just that it came out while I was waiting.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I wanted to ask you, do you think that it's immoral for us, those of us Christians who are wealthy, just to spend all their excess money on their lifestyle and knowing full well that millions of other fellow believers are going hungry and unloved, unwitnessed to, and remaining unreached, you know?
Yeah, I definitely feel like it's immoral because it's stealing. Stealing because when people have a lot of money and they spend it all on their lifestyle, that is all on their enjoyment, and don't help the poor. That's definitely immoral. One of the few clear commands of Scripture is to help the poor. And the Bible teaches that whatever money we have isn't ours. Anyway, it's God's money. So he's given us his money to manage. And we're going to have to answer to him for how we managed it. Now, if we knew about the poor and we did nothing for them, if we knew about the expenses of spreading the gospel to the foreign lands and didn't do anything to support that when we could have.
But he does, you know. You can't avoid it, you know.
Or
whatever, you know. No. I just don't know how they could do it in good conscience. And will they be judged for it, you know?
Well, I think there's a lot of people who are not Christians who think they are. Remember what John said? John said, if a brother or sister has this world's goods and sees his brother or sister in need and shuts up his compassion from him, how does the love of God dwell in him? Now, if you don't have love of God in you, you don't have God. That's what John in the same epistle, he said, whosoever loves is born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God. So one of the ways you know you are a Christian is that you have the love of God for other people in you.
And
if you have the ability to help somebody and you don't, it seems to bear strong testimony about the absence of love and therefore the absence of salvation.
It's something that was bothering me. You know, I have some wealthy family members, and they do a little bit, but it just seems overall, is like you see celebrities, Christians, or whatnot, they pay lip service to God, but they don't really do anything about it.
Well, we don't know how much they may do. I mean, some of them, maybe we do know some of them, but I don't know how much they do. See, when I see a rich Christian, he's living richer than I am, I'm not sure that he's sinning because he may be giving a big chunk of his money away that I don't know about. And the lifestyle that he's living may actually be something that he feels is useful in his his type of ministry that he's doing. I don't know. I'm not going to judge a man for how much or for what percentage they need to give away or what percentage they're allowed to live on. I personally, my own convictions, I would live as inexpensively as I can and give away as much as I can.
That's how I do, and I think it's a reasonable duty, you know?
Yeah, but we can't...
I don't know how somebody... Maybe they're... Of course, I'm thinking of super televangelists. I don't know. But it seems to me that there probably are a lot of people buying, gold-plated doorknobs for their house.
Well, there is that going on.
Not even getting a second thought to anybody else, you know?
Yeah, there that is going on with some of the Christian TV evangelists and stuff. They really do have a lot of fancy junk that they spend a lot of money on, when they, which is, to my mind, inexcusable. Now, when I said that it's immoral to hoard all your money and use it on yourself and not share with others who are in need, what I mean to make clear is that everyone should see themselves as the steward of God's things and know that God's priority is not for you to have golden doorknobs or even the newest model of cars, but for you, God's priorities are to see the poor fed and housed and cared for, and also the gospel preached in all the world. And if there are expenses associated with those things, and I'm doing very luxurious things with my own lifestyle and not giving, well, then I would suggest that that's immoral. And like John said, it shows you don't have the love of God in you. But if you do have the love of God in you, it doesn't guarantee that you'll give X number of dollars away or X number of dollars you'll live on. Those are stewardship decisions that everyone has to make in their own heart before God. And I can't judge, and you can't judge another steward, but if they are very wasteful, if it's a friend of yours, you have every right to speak into their life and say, you know, this seems wasteful. But if they say, well, you don't know how much I'm actually giving, and you don't know my reasons for doing what I'm doing with my money here, then I think you have to step back and say, well, okay, I mean, God is your judge. I'm not going to judge you. And God is their judge. And sometimes people who think they're doing maybe the right thing with their money may be surprised. And Jesus will say, I was hungry and you didn't feed me. Depart into everlasting punishment. You know, so, I mean, that is what he's going to say to some people. And so I really, you know, I think this is something that every Christian needs to have a tender conscience about. But no one can really judge another Christian as to how much they have to spend on lifestyle or, and how much they have to spend on, you know, their giving and other generous things. This is an individual matter, but I'm glad you brought it up, because I think it's true that many American Christians need to realize that we are spending far more on our standard of living in many cases than what Jesus would do if he had the money in his hands, and he's supposed to. I mean, if the money's in your hands, it's supposed to be in his hands, and it should be going out of your hands toward the things that would go out of his hands for. If you're his body, if you represent Christ in the world, then certainly what you have is his, and what you do with it should reflect what he wants done with it. And to the degree that we don't follow that principle, there will be some great shame and consequences when he calls his stewards to give account. And some will be in outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth, Jesus said. Anyway, Daniel, I appreciate your question there. I'm going to have to take another call. Your phone, by the way, was very hard to understand you. I think you had a bad connection there. But let's talk to Brandon from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Brandon, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah.
I just had a couple questions for you. First, I was going to start with about the caller from yesterday.
Okay.
He had said he wasn't sure about animals having souls or something like that. And I had looked it up previously, and it seems like the word soup, if you can correct me, I don't know how to pronounce it, in the Greek,
suke, suke,
H or something?
Yeah, suke.
Referring to animals and like sacrifices and stuff, but I don't have the exact verse or anything.
Right.
So
well,
I was
the word suke.
Does suk mean soul?
Suke is translated soul from the Greek. In the Old Testament, nephesh is the word that's translated soul from the Hebrew. The word nephesh is used for humans and animals alike. I'm not aware. I don't know whether the word suke is used for animals in the Greek. I don't think it is in the Bible, but it may be, or maybe it was in the Septuagint. I don't know. It's possible. But the point is that suke and nephesh are not exactly words that have exactly the same range of meaning. And even if we translate it as soul, it's a different issue than whether it's an eternal soul. I mean, an animal might be called a soul and not tell us anything about whether it lives on after death. And that's, I think, what the guy was asking about.
Okay. Yeah, it seems like some people believe there's a difference between spiritual and just the soul. Like unbelievers have a
right.
soul, but they don't. Their spirit doesn't go to God. I believe the website I came across was very convincing, and I just it talked about suke in the Bible.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. My other question was about I'm actually to preface this I'm actually I'm a preterist, and I'm looking into full preterism.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a little bit cautious about it, but a lot of the arguments are very, very sound to me. But there's a few of them, but I just wanted to take one with you today. And this may not have anything to do with full preterism versus partial, but it's in Acts chapter 1:11.
Okay.
When
the angel said that Jesus will return in like manner.
Yeah, I was just thinking, they believe he came in judgment on the clouds. I think you do too. Well, it says this Jesus who has been taken up from you into heaven, as you know, will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And my idea is, it doesn't say form, it says the same way. And the way they saw him go was in the clouds.
Well, I don't believe Jesus came back in the clouds literally in 70 AD. I believe that a judgment from God came on Jerusalem in 70 AD, and that this judgment from God is figuratively in Scripture mentioned as the Lord coming. And this is a very typical figure of speech in the Scripture, in the Old Testament and the New, to speak about some temporal judgment from God as being God coming. Now, I don't believe that those who use that figure of speech mean that God literally comes at that time. But he sends armies he is sovereignly bringing armies against a nation. And it is as if he is coming, as if he is riding at the head of the armies. That's not necessarily to be taken literal. It's a figurative, poetic way of speaking. So I do believe that many references to the coming of the Son of Man are references to what happened in 70 AD, but I don't believe he came in the sense of that he went away and came back. I believe that it's a figure of speech to say that was his coming. And I think it's consistent with the same figure of speech found in the Old Testament as well.
Okay. I just know that some people were pointing out that the same way is in like manner in the Greek, I think, or something like that.
Uh-huh,
and in
uh-huh.
like manner just doesn't always mean exactly the same.
I know.
Because after all, he'd have to come back in the same spot and everything.
Right, and some think he's going to do that too. Right, I agree with you. I don't think his return has to be exactly in every point the same, but I do think it has to be as real. I think his departure was a real catching up, and his return will be a real coming down. I don't think
okay.
that's happened yet.
Well, to me, it doesn't seem like it has to be. I mean, there's
okay.
at least the possibility that when it says he'll come the same way as he went in the clouds, so he'll also come in the clouds.
Okay. Well, but, I mean, if that's satisfied to you, I mean, there are. You're right. I've read full preterist arguments who say essentially the same thing. You know. So I mean, I can't say that in like manner has to mean in all ways the same, so that's an argument you can have.
Okay.
I'm not persuaded of it. To me, it's not intuitively correct.
Yeah, I know you're
probably
aware of it.
Oh, yeah.
But I just wanted to bring it up because I thought it was a valid point. I just don't see any real basis for him having to come back in the same form that he went.
Yeah.
But,
well, you know, I think that many of the arguments for full preterism are valid, but not all. And that's why I'm a partial preterist. I agree with them on the ones that are valid, and I disagree with the ones that I don't think are valid. The one you raised, I don't think is as valid as they think, but it's not impossible. I mean, I don't have anything, any emotional stake in that particular verse being more literal. But I will say this, that when I read Scripture, I try to understand it the way that the original hearers would have understood it. And that's not always easy to do, but it's something I attempt to do. And in my attempts to understand that particular verse, it seems to me that this was not just predicting that he'd come through the Roman armies and destroy Jerusalem. That would not necessarily be a particularly comforting announcement to the disciples at that point, since they were living in Jerusalem at that time. But, you know, that he would come back and they'd see him again and be rejoined to him is I think, the nature of that promise. And if I'm, you know, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But, I mean, that's certainly the way I would see it.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you accepting my call. Me and my roommate listen to you all the time.
Well, did you know I'm debating Don Preston on Full Preterism in Denver at the beginning of next month?
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
He's kind of a heavyweight.
Yeah, he is. And
I
never actually heard of him until I was asked to debate him. But I'm going to Denver. It'll be the 6th, 7th, and 8th of September. And we're going to debate in the Denver area. There's information about that soon to be at my website if it's not there yet. Hopefully it will be soon.
Okay. Well, perfect. Thanks a bunch, Steve. I really appreciate your show.
Okay, Brandon. God bless you.
All right, God bless you.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye now. All right. Daryl from Eugene, Oregon is next. Daryl, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Daryl, are you there? We got a bad connection, it looks like. Going once, going twice. There's no Daryl there. Maybe he needs to call back. Daryl, please call back, and maybe we'll get a better connection. Okay, we got another Arthur calling from Portland. We had an Arthur from Salinas earlier. Arthur, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I just wanted to know where the Bible says we have one mediator between God and man, and that's Christ. And also where it says faith comes by hearing. And I also wanted to know, how can we know the difference between, or is there a difference between heresy and wrong doctrine? And should all wrong doctrine, should we react to it the same way that the Bible exhorts us to react to heresy? And how
well,
should we react to heresy?
Heresy, I actually think that, I think that heresy refers to somebody who's dividing the body of Christ through their wrong doctrine.
Okay.
A person can be wrong about many things without being divisive.
Right.
And so there's, you know, I would say that heresy and wrong doctrine are not necessarily the same, although heresy would be used for certain wrong doctrines, but they'd have to be pretty, they'd be pretty severe ones, I would think. So that would be my own thoughts about that. There are many things that people could have wrong doctrines about that are more or less innocent mistakes and which are not themselves divisive because they're not being divisive about it. So that would be my thoughts about that. Now, the statement that there's one God and one mediator between God and man, that's Paul wrote that to Timothy. And to tell you the truth, because I don't have a concordance in front of me, the actual reference I'm forgetting, which is strange because I knew that verse from my childhood. But, you know, when you get to be about 60, things you know really well sometimes slip away.
No problem.
As far as faith comes by hearing, I know where that one's from. That comes from Romans chapter 10.
Thanks.
That you did ask about that, right?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, that's Romans 10, 17. And I'm sure that someone will call up because probably about 50% of our listeners have memorized there's one God and one mediator between God and man, just like I did when I was young. And they have the reference at their fingertips. They'll probably call up and let you know.
Does that just simply mean what it says, that we have only one entity between us and our Father, and that's Jesus? Or
well, he's the only one who can bring us to God.
Right.
Yeah, to say that he stands between us and God is not even accurate. Jesus doesn't stand between us and God. He brings us to God. He's our advocate. He stands alongside. The Paracletos stands alongside and helps.
Our advocate, yeah.
Yeah, he's our advocate. Now, Jesus made it very clear that we can come directly to the Father through him.
Yeah.
We don't come to him and then he goes to the Father. He actually made that distinction when he was talking about this very thing in John chapter 16. He said, you know, in the future, Well, let me read it to you here. Verse 26, John 16, 26, in that day you will ask in my name. I do not say that I shall pray to the Father for you, for the Father himself loves you, because you have loved me and have believed that I came from God. In other words, I'm not going to go for you. You talk to him yourself. So, I mean, God is listening to you because you are in Christ. But Christ is the only one through whom you can actually come to God. That's the fact.
Right on. All right. Do Catholics feel like they could come through sometimes that Mary could intercede for them, or that in the sense that saints like St. Augustine or St. Francis can intercede for them?
Yeah. Yeah, Roman Catholics believe that.
Okay. And is that contrary to Timothy, to 1 Timothy?
I think it is. By the way, the verse you're looking for is 1 Timothy 2:5. I've been looking for it since you asked. 1 Timothy 2:5 is there's one God and one mediator between God and men. The Roman Catholics would say it doesn't violate that because in their view, when they talk to Mary, they say they're just asking Mary to pray for them. And they say it's not much different than if you ask me to pray for you. You know, if you're going through something, say, oh, please pray for me. They say that that's what they're doing when they speak to Mary or to the saints.
In their prayers, though, it sounds different, though. I mean, it sounds greater than just me saying to my buddy John or my buddy Steve, hey, pray for me. It sounds like a last-minute thing right before they die, like, please intercede for me, intercede for my soul. You know?
Yeah, they do. They do. They actually think that God's going to listen to saints and to Mary more than he might listen to you or me. That's why they talk to her. Sometimes they say that, you know, Jesus would never say no to his mother from a request from his mother. Well, if there's something I would ask God that he would not wish to do, that is, if I'm praying against his will, I don't think that it should be Mary's will. Why would Mary want it to be true if God doesn't? You know, if Mary wants my prayer to be answered and she's going to go talk to Jesus or talk to God about it, does that mean she wants things to happen that God doesn't? I mean, if my prayer is according to the will of God, why can't God just grant it? And if it's not according to the will of God, why would Mary grant it? You know, to me, they definitely, it's not the same. It's with them. It's not the same as when you say, hey, Steve, pray for me. I'm going through something. It's analogous to them. They say it's similar, but it's very different. For one thing, if I ask you to pray for me, I know you can hear me and you can pray for me. If I pray to a dead person, I don't have any reason to believe they can hear me. And I have no reason to pray to them since, I mean, I don't know. Why should I believe that they hear me talking to them?
Right.
You see?
Right.
It's one thing to say that, you know, if a saint would pray for me or if Mary would pray for me, that's as good as having you pray for me or better, maybe. I don't know. But why should I think that she could hear me?
Yeah. Yeah. Right on. Thanks, man. That's super helpful.
All right. Well, good talking to you.
All right. Bye.
Okay. Bye now. All right. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are, about 10 minutes away from the end of the program. Our lines have cleared. If you'd like to be on the program, you could get right through. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Carmen wrote and asked, in the Old Testament, why does God tolerate polygamy? Well, that actually came up on our show today, you know, that perhaps polygamy will someday be legal in this country. Why does God tolerate it in the Old Testament? Well, I would have to say the simple answer, I don't mean to be flip, but it's the simplest answer, is that God is very tolerant. God tolerates a great deal of imperfection in man, because if he didn't, he'd have to wipe us all out. Now, what do we mean by tolerant? Some people think tolerant means approving. This is a bad development of our modern politically correct society. When people are asking for tolerance, nowadays what they mean, they want you to approve of what they're doing. If they, you know, we need more tolerance, that means we need to approve of more weird ways of life. Well, that's not what tolerance means. Tolerance means, well, here's a dictionary definition of tolerance. It says to allow the existence, occurrence, or practice of something that one does not necessarily like or agree with, without interference. A second definition is to accept or endure something unpleasant or disliked with forbearance. So tolerating doesn't mean that you approve. Tolerating means you don't approve. If you do approve, you don't have to tolerate it. That is what tolerance speaks of, having forbearance has to do with allowing someone to do something that you don't approve of without interfering with them. That's what tolerance means. And to say, why did God tolerate polygamy? I guess it's simply he didn't choose to judge it. He didn't choose to wipe people out who did it. There's lots of sins that people did in the Old Testament or even now. There's even sins that Christians do that God tolerates in the sense that he doesn't interfere with it. There will be a judgment, though, and anyone who violates his commands will face judgment. But tolerance is something that God has to do all the time. Think of all the sin that's going on in the world that he tolerates rather than hurling lightning bolts and destroying everyone who does them right away. God is very tolerant, but that doesn't mean he approves of certain things. Now, there's some things that he is very, what shall we say, vehemently opposed to. Other things are simply imperfect. And, you know, he wishes they were better, but, you know, they're not as offensive as some other things are. Like if you're murdering babies, that's a terrible thing. God, I mean, if God tolerates that, he does so with great wrath stored up against those who do it. Other things are just imperfect, like polygamy, frankly. It's an imperfect variation on marriage. God didn't create polygamy. He created monogamy. However, sometimes a man would marry a woman and she couldn't have children, and so he'd marry a second wife. Now, he wouldn't divorce the first. See, here, we do polygamy in this country. We tolerate it. We just allow a man or a woman to dump their former spouse and take a new one. In the Bible, they couldn't, at least they weren't supposed to do that. If they wanted to, if they had to have babies and their wife couldn't have babies, they'd take another wife, it may be. Now, the Bible didn't authorize this. This is just what people did. And the fact that God didn't judge it doesn't mean that that's his idea of ideal marriage. So if we ask, why did God tolerate anything? The very fact that he tolerated it means he didn't like it much, but he didn't choose to interfere. And if God isn't willing to tolerate a great number of things, he'd just be incinerating everyone right and left, because there's all kinds of things he puts up with from all of us. That was one thing he put up with for a long time without interference. Let's talk to Jack from Monterey, California. Jack, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I was calling, I'm studying through Genesis, and I'm calling about Methuselah.
Uh-huh.
And the definition of his name, I'd always heard that it was when he dies or when he is gone, it will come, referring to the flood. And that,
right.
And that the last year, or when he did die, that same year the flood came. However, I couldn't find that in the definition of his name, like in the places I looked. It was more like
right.
Dart.
Yeah. I'm with you. So I'm with you. I've looked that up, too. I've looked that up, too, and I can't find it in the authorities I have. And yet, you know, Bible teachers, scholars, and preachers have been saying that as long as I've been alive. They say that the name Methuselah means when he is dead, it will come, or when he is dead, it will be sent. And I just haven't, in my lexicons and stuff, I haven't found any confirmation of that. So I'm very curious to know where that information comes from.
Yeah.
I can't answer it.
Yeah, a tradition maybe, and who knows where it began. Okay, well, moving one other one then. As far as the from the verse, Jesus Christ the same yesterday and today and forever, and that in light of him, you know, the Son of Man and being, you know, born of Mary, you know, of course the Holy Spirit being the Father, and but still, you know, being born of the seed of man, just how do you look at that as far as you know, that there's no new thing that took place there with Jesus?
Well, you know, it's interesting, the statement in Hebrews that you're quoting there in from chapter 13, it doesn't actually say that he's always been exactly the same. It says Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever. I'm not sure what he means by yesterday. Yesterday isn't necessarily the same thing as eternity past. Maybe the author is saying, you know, yesterday or in the recent past, Jesus was among us. He's still with us today, and he's with us forever, and he's the same Jesus you know, all along. I don't know that he's saying that prior to his incarnation, he was no different than he is now, because I think he did undergo change there, and I think the whole teaching of the New Testament would suggest that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that kind of makes sense. It would seem that way. Okay, Steve. Thanks a lot. Good talking to you. I appreciate it.
All right, Jack. Good talking to you. God bless you. Susan from Sacramento is next, and we only have a minute or two. I'm sorry to say, Susan, welcome.
Hi. I have a quick question. I know that Jesus' life was documented when he was very young, when he was young, and then it was documented his ministry when he was older, but there's a period of time there. Is there anything documented, or did any historian write down what he did in, like, the middle of his life? Because I had a friend ask me a question about that, and they say that he traveled to the East and everything, and he became a Buddhist and all this, which was off the wall.
Right.
And I wanted to know if there's any documentation saying otherwise.
What your friend said is New Age. The New Age movement basically says that Jesus, during the 18 years between age 12 and age 30, that he traveled to Nepal, he traveled to India, he traveled to Egypt, he learned magic, he learned the occult, he learned meditation, all that stuff. And although the Bible doesn't tell us exactly what he did all of those 18 years, I think the reason it's left out is because it was not anything very significant to report. I think he worked in a carpenter shop.
Mm-hmm.
When he was 30 years old and he came back to preach in his town, they all knew him as the carpenter, you know.
Okay.
And as far as him learning from the East, even if someone wants to say,
because he taught different.
Exactly. He didn't teach what Eastern mystics taught.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't teach Buddhism. He doesn't teach Hinduism.
No.
He doesn't teach magic. He doesn't teach any of those things.
So
to suggest that he went and learned those things is just not in touch with the records of what we know about him. We don't know, we don't know what he was doing every day or every year of that 18 years, but it's not likely that he had the money to travel internationally. He was a peasant, and, he was working in a carpenter shop. He was the son of a carpenter. And, there's really nothing suggesting otherwise. And if someone says, well, he went and he learned from these great masters and these gurus and stuff and from the magicians in Egypt and came back, and that's how he had all these powers and stuff. Well, it certainly is
the opposite of them.
Exactly. It'd be the opposite of what he said about himself. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I just wanted to know if anything was documented during that time. I just wanted more proof.
We don't. The only history we have about Jesus in any detail is, of course, that in the Gospels. And you can see, of course, for yourself that the Gospels don't record that period of time, which is what has given people occasion to speculate about, well, I wonder what he was doing. But one thing we know he wasn't doing is he was not learning from the East, or if he was, he rejected everything he learned there because he taught against that stuff. You know, one thing we know that Eastern religions have always taught is karma and reincarnation. And under that system, you do not suffer for righteousness' sake, you suffer for your bad karma. And Jesus taught that people suffer for righteousness' sake in many cases and said they're blessed if they do. He also didn't teach reincarnation. He taught resurrection of the dead at the last day. All the dead will be raised. And so, I mean, Jesus didn't teach anything resembling Eastern mysticism or magic. As far as his mighty works, he said the Father in him was doing those works, not some kind of magical spells he was using. There were people who did cast out demons through magical spells, and he didn't do anything like what they did. He just commanded demons to come out, and they obeyed him because of his authority as the Son of God. Well, we're out of time, I'm sorry to say. However, Lord willing, there's tomorrow we can talk again. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from our website, which is www.thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us, and let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.